call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Friday, January 24th. The time is 3:31 p.m. So welcome everyone. Karen is our secretary today. Thank you very much, Karen. Shane and Alex are on the recording tasks this afternoon. Committee members present, Senator Machicki and myself, Senator Giesel. Excused absences, Senator Dyson, Fairclough, Bishop, McGuire, and French. So, some of you may have a question about quorum based on the numerous excused absences. So I refer you to Section 613, Number 1 of the Mason's Manual, which this meeting is testimony in hearings of a public nature which do not require a quorum. So just for clarification. So thank you so much to the Department of Natural Resources, who's here today to brief us on the various divisions in the department, and we get an opportunity to meet all of the heads of those divisions. So thanks very much for being here. I'll invite Commissioner Balash to the table, and I'll let you kick it off here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Joe Balash. I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Natural Resources. What we have here for the committee this afternoon is an overview of what we accomplished in calendar year 2013. In the first session of this legislature, we were able to provide a fairly detailed overview as to the functions of each division within the department. At DNR, we are the primary land manager for the 100-plus million acres of uplands that the state owns as part of its entitlement under statehood. And in addition to that, we have another incredibly large amount of acreage associated with our near-shore tidelands, submerged lands under rivers and lakes, and that adds up to somewhere between 45 and 60 million acres in addition to those uplands. We have a variety of divisions who carry out different functions to manage different lands according to their resource potential. And I just want to identify for the committee our organization chart. With the departure of Dan Sullivan as commissioner, I was named in November to be the commissioner that required the backfilling of my former position. Bob Swenson, formerly the state geologist, was, he made the unfortunate decision to say yes. And that required backfilling his position with a gentleman named Steve Masterman, who you'll get to meet in a little bit. The overall structure of the department remains the same. The various divisions and offices that previously reported to Ed Fogles continue to do so, and my former reports now tie into Bob. I really would like to spend the time here going through the slides with each division director speaking to their own accomplishments. Between the finance committees and the resources they've provided, as well as the tools that have been provided through statute, we've accomplished a lot in 2013. For myself, a lot of that was spent indoors working on the heads of agreement, which we'll get to start talking about next week, so I won't spend much time on it. But our first director is not able to be with us. That is Acting Director Eric Hattelberg from the Gas Pipeline Project Office. He is on his way back from Houston, completing one of our monthly monitoring meetings for the AGIA licensee. Every month, Eric and his team travel to either Houston, Calgary, or both to make sure that we are, in fact, receiving the benefits of the obligations taken under by TC Alaska under the terms of their AGIA license. And while we expect to transition out of that framework and arrangement later this year, it remains in effect, and we continue to undertake our responsibilities to make sure that the activities are being done properly, and those reports help feed into the reimbursement process that the Department of Revenue administers. So aside from that, the things that we've relied on the Gas Pipeline Project Office to keep an eye on for us include hosting the state's presence at LNG 17, which I believe both of the senators here today attended. We were able to have a presence there on the floor and make sure people knew that we were in fact part of the scene, and I think that was quite helpful. Eric and the team were also able to contribute technical expertise and input to Black & Veatch as they undertook our royalty study over the course of the summer and fall. And they met with numerous LNG buyers that came into Alaska over the course of this past year. And that's been a positive thing. And while we don't necessarily have any LNG to sell them just yet, understanding what the market has to say about the project and the opportunity is very important to our ultimate success. The Gas Pipeline Project Office is also the place that has signed a formal MOU with an outfit called REI. And that particular organization represents a consortium of commercial interests in Japan that are interested in buying LNG and doing so in a fashion that is a little bit different than has been done in the past. And while the MOUs that have been signed with REI are non-binding, non-exclusive, it has represented a formal acknowledgement of their interest as well as our willingness to work with them on matters of mutual benefit. The original MOU with REI was targeting North Slope Gas. However, as time has gone on, it was very clear that REI was interested in a date that occurs in 2019. And it does not appear that any of the North Slope timelines would match up with that. And so they refocused their effort to a much smaller volume and looking for supply centered in Cook Inlet. And so we'll see just how far they're able to get on things. That really, I think, concludes this part of the presentation. And what we're going to try and do is have a rotation. We'll try to be as efficient and quiet as we can doing that process. And the next person up is our director of the Division of Agriculture, Ms. Francie Havemeister.
Great. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Francie Havemeister. I'm the director for the Division of Ag. The division's mission is to promote and encourage the agriculture industry within the state, and that is done through several of our components. One of them, which is the inspection section. In 2012 and 2013, we conducted pest surveys on diseases and pests of concern to agricultural and natural resources and international trade. Surveys were conducted for Lepidoptera pests, which are large insects, and Stevia-root nematodes and thrips. The absence or presence of a pest determines treatment that may or may not be necessary to exporting a product such as peony or timber. Inspections were conducted at the U.S.-Canada border in cooperation with Custom Border Patrol in an effort to evaluate pest pathways and movement of products of concern. Items detained as a result of these inspections included seed potatoes and tomato plants, as they lacked the appropriate certification to enter the state. We performed timber and agricultural export certification on over $143 million of timber in fiscal year 13, which was bound for export to Korea, China, and Japan markets. The peony industry continues to expand, and last year shipments were sent to Taiwan. The land section staff continues to identify with soils suitable for ag production. Staff working in cooperation with Mining Land and Water increased agriculture land designations by 35,000 acres in the Yukon-Tanana area plan. Discussions have continued with farmers and stakeholders regarding the agricultural land program. Six meetings were held this past year addressing topics such as clearing requirements, future sales, and agriculture covenants. The Plant Materials Center is a 407-acre production farm that produces foundation seed for grain and native grass growers, produces Generation Zero seed potatoes for certified seed producers, houses the only certified seed lab within the state, as well as the only seed cleaning facility within the state. Variety trials were conducted on that farm for onions and asparagus, apple rootstock, as well as potatoes. We're currently working with ADF&G and DEC on efforts to control the spread of Elodia. We held public meetings in Anchorage and Homer to discuss treatment options and are working with both of these departments to establish guidelines on permitting requirements for treatment. The marketing section continues to explore the innovative ways to market Alaska Grown. We've increased Alaska Grown Farm membership, adding 75 new farm businesses to the program, which is a 13% increase over 2012. The Alaska Grown Facebook page remains content-driven, continues to be an effective tool for outreach and education, and has over 15,000 likes and hundreds of daily traffic daily. The restaurant reward program in 2013 had 21 participating restaurants, which increased their use of Alaska Grown by 44% over the previous year. Markets able to accept Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, otherwise known as SNAP, in 2013 doubled from 5 to 10, bringing approximately $30,000 of additional dollars to these Alaska markets. These markets are located throughout the state, Sitka, Bethel, Fairbanks, South Central, and on the Kenai. The Farm to School program was selected to receive the Alaska Community Service Award for Health at the Alaska Health Summit Awards Luncheon this upcoming January 29th. In recognition of an organization that is making a significant contribution to improving the health of Alaskans. We've provided on-farm food safety workshops with 50 producers in attendance. 76% of those indicated they would make changes to their farming practice as a result. 25 of 51 school food service directors completed our farm-to-school survey, and 100% of those survey participants agreed that there had been an increase in local food served in schools as a direct result of the farm-to-school program. The Farm to School program and projects have been successful throughout the state and recognized nationally, with 87% of Alaska school districts actively engaged in the program, which is 47 out of 54. The following is a quote from Stacy Sobel, which is a Western regional lead for the National Farm to School Network. Alaska is recognized as a national leader in farm to school, producing models that have been shared with and emulated by other states across the country. And closing, the Alaska Food Resource Working Group was formed through Administrative Order 265, which was the direct result of HCR1. The objective of this order is to improve the health of state residents, increase food security, strengthen local economies, and encourage community development. This group has met twice, chaired by the Commissioner of DNR, with the latest meeting held early January at the Plant Materials Center, and which included invited testimony from vegetable producers in the valley. This group will provide recommendations for policy changes that will increase the use of locally grown and harvested food, which will provide additional markets for Alaska's producers. With that, I'll turn it over to Chris.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Senator. For the record, my name is Chris Mache, the Director of the Division of Forestry. I'd like to spend the next few minutes speaking with you and highlighting our key accomplishments this past year in both our wildland fire and our forest management programs. I'd like to begin by reviewing our mission statement, which enumerates our core missions, which are serving Alaskans through forest management and wildland fire protection. And I would like to describe the inset photos here on the first slide. This is a picture of some wood pellets that are produced up at Superior Hardwoods up in North Pole, Alaska. These pellets are produced for both residential and commercial heating purposes, made from 100% Alaska wood. And if you'll note on the bags there that are ready for shipment, the Alaska Produce logo is on those bags. And so that's really something that we like to see. Like I said, all that wood comes from the State Forest, Tanana Valley State Forest, and state-owned land. So it's really a nice success story from our point of view. So with that, I'd like to go into some more specifics. We are continuing to implement the Governor's Alaska Timber Jobs Task Force report and recommendations contained within. Three of the items this year, we established a roads office within the Division of Forestry and have two positions that we repurposed from other positions and hired two logging engineers into those positions to help with infrastructure development and access projects on state forest lands. We are also promoting the proposed Susitna State Forest, which is House Bill 79 and Senate Bill 28, which I'm hopeful you'll have before your committee at some point this session. We are also using some money that was appropriated last year in a CIP, $2 million to develop access projects. The projects we're focused on are in southern southeast at Gravina Island and Edna Bay. Moving back up to the interior in Tok, Alaska, we offered a 25-year long timber sale to help support a combined heat and power project for Alaska Power and Telephone, who had expressed interest in producing both energy and heat in a project. The sale was for 35,000 green tons of material annually. Unfortunately, they had reached the decision point that they have not gone forward with that project. So that sale is currently available on what we call over-the-counter, so if anyone could step in and purchase it. It's sold under our competitive authorities, and we are actually just started this week speaking with a company that's expressed some interest in potentially stepping in and continuing that project. In addition, we sold 16.4 million board feet of timber to over 37 Alaskan companies, and that ranges from southern southeast Alaska all the way up through interior Alaska and locations in between. These are the small sawmills that produce high-value-added lumber and other products that is for in-state use. We also provided direct and indirect support to over 105 woody biomass projects that are being considered, have already been built, or are under construction around the state with AEA. And we are the people that supply the wood supply if it's not coming from private lands. And so I'm happy to say we've been able to support a number of those projects, notably in Tok and Delta with state wood, but also in more remote locations of the state, too. And then, of course, we continue to work with the U.S. Forest Service to implement the 2008 Tongass Land Management Plan and support the remaining timber industry that's located in southeast Alaska. Moving on, I'll shift gears to the Wildland Fire Program, and I'd have to say our most notable accomplishment in that regard was the successful and safe response to our fourth largest fire season in the past 10 years. 1.3 million acres burned, and we had over 613 fires. And that's actually a record number of fire starts for a given fire season. It's also our second largest season in the past 5 years, to help put it in context. So a very challenging year, a lot of resources from the lower 48, and then as our season wound down, we sent a lot of resources to them in the lower 48 because they also had a very challenging year. We continue to build out and deploy our integrated fire management software tool, which is a dispatch tool, finance tracking, and it helps improve our initial attack and our overall management of the fire program. On the aviation side, we've completed the procurement of a safer air attack platform by acquiring one aero turbine commander, and we are just about ready to close on the second aircraft this month. You might recall that those replaced some Pilatus PC-7s that used to perform that role previously. They were single-engine aircraft. These are dual engine aircraft that are turbines, so a safer platform. We can conduct training and other activities we couldn't in the other planes, so those planes were sold. We also completed training of our wildland fire crew bosses at a crew boss academy. We had 20 students from around the state of Alaska. 17 different communities were represented, most of those communities off the grid, so our more rural communities. And the picture here is of the two young ladies that have a lot of energy and our two crew bosses. And the crew bosses are in charge of a 19-person crew, typically from the communities they hail from. And that's an EFF, emergency firefighter, type 2 crew. And these two had a lot of energy. They're holding pictures of the full graduating class in their full turnout gear, standing in front of our Convair 580s, which are our retardant air tankers. I know they're a little hard to see in those small pictures. But if you look at the background piece there, you'll see the other major aviation asset we use, which is the CL-215 water scooping aircraft. Those are actually brought on by the Alaska Fire Service, but we trade the use back and forth based on the type of fire and the type of aircraft that we need. So it's a good relationship we have with them. This coming year, we have partnered with the University of Alaska Fairbanks for them to actually offer the Wildland Fire Program and to deliver it, which takes some of the effort off our staff from a training standpoint. And it will also allow us to offer credit at the academy, university credit for the students that are actually taking it. So it gets them started, hopefully, on a career where they might consider an associate degree in wildland fire science, and eventually perhaps even go further and hopefully join our ranks in the Division of Forestry at some point in the future. On that note, we also offered 14 internships this past year for the first time to previous graduates of either the basic or the Advanced Wildland Fire Academies. It gives them a whole summer season where we rotate them through different fire positions in the division and give them experience and exposure to those types of careers. And, of course, it's our hope some of them will join us permanently in the future. So it's a pipeline of developing candidates and recruiting. We also competed successfully in the West for over $1 million in competitive funds with our sister states for hazard fuel mitigation projects. And we had four projects that were awarded this past year in the Mat-Su, in Fairbanks, the Kenai, and in Tok. And these projects help reduce high-risk fuels around communities to lower the risk of wildland fire actually damaging, important things located in those locations. It's a very important part of our CREW program in addition. And then finally, we developed a project and concept paper for a wildland fire center in interior Alaska that would help replace very old facilities that are outdated and high maintenance items. And we did that in collaboration with the Cold Climate Housing Research Center at the university, who's well known for their ability to design residential structures that are energy efficient and very efficient in their construction. We're hoping to demonstrate that same type of effort on the commercial side. So this whole project, the suite of buildings, have been designed in conjunction with them to help demonstrate some of those techniques. So with that, I will close my comments and pass it off to my colleague.
Thanks.
Thank you, Chris. And for the record, my name is Steve Masterman. I am Acting Director of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys, or DGGS as we call ourselves. And DGGS's mission is to determine the potential of Alaska land for production of metals, minerals, fuels, and geothermal resources, location supplies of groundwater and construction materials, and the potential geologic hazards to buildings, roads, bridges, other installations, communities, that sort of thing. Our division is divided into six sections, and I'll just very briefly go through some of the major accomplishments for each section. The mineral section, which determines potential state lands to host mineral occurrences, was heavily involved in the Strategic and Critical Minerals Project this last year, and mapped and sampled and assessed an area of about 2,600 square miles between Paxson and Talkeetna, looking at its potential to hold platinum group metals. There are some platinum group occurrences around Tangle Lakes, and we are extending that knowledge southwest from there. As part of that project, this group has just passed the 10,000 sample mark for the number of samples that have been analyzed, and new samples and old samples that were reanalyzed, and we're making that data available as we get it through our website for industry. We had a very busy year with the Airborne Geophysical Program, either acquiring or publishing over 4,500 square miles of new airborne geophysical data. And that was in four different surveys around the state. And that's quite a lot more than we have been doing in the past. And part of the big increase is due to the Strategic Critical Minerals funding. Mm-hmm. As part of our mapping project, we also assessed and mapped a 200-square-mile area in the Styx River region, which is in the west-central Alaska Range. And that's an area that has several advanced stage exploration copper and gold occurrences, so industry is very keen to learn more about the geology in that part of the world. The energy section continued their work in Cook Inlet and on the North Slope by mapping. In Cook Inlet, they mapped about a 250-square-mile area on the Inniskan Peninsula, which is in western Cook Inlet, and there they were looking at the deeper part of the stratigraphy, which are the source rocks for the oil and gas accumulations in northern Cook Inlet. During that work, they discovered a couple of new oil-stained outcrops, which is always of great excitement to us and industry. On the North Slope, the energy section collaborated with the University of Alaska Fairbanks and the USGS working on the shale oil potential up there, and we will be back this coming summer to conduct more field work on that project as well. Finally, for the energy section, we completed a compilation of geothermal data from all the available sources for the state, and that was finished up in December, and we are getting ready to publish that on our website digitally as well as in hard copy.
Great. Senator Michiki, did you have a question?
I did. Just can you define the purpose of airborne geophysical data and how that's obtained, stored, cataloged?
Through the chair, I'd be happy to, Senator Machicki. When we fly airborne geophysical data, we collect various types of airborne information, and typically we always collect magnetic data, which allows us to look at the magnetite content of the rocks, and then it allows the geologists to map the various rock formations in places where perhaps rocks are not sticking out of the ground. We also collect information about the electrical conductivity of the rocks, and similarly different rocks behave differently, and so some rocks are more conductive than others, and that allows us again to map the geology. One aspect of airborne geophysics is that mineral deposits very commonly have characteristic signatures in both magnetic and resistivity information. So by looking at the geology and the airborne geophysical data, you can use it as a directly as a prospecting tool. Okay. And so it's of great interest to industry. There's usually a notable spike in industry activity whenever we release the airborne geophysical data.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the Geological Material Center is a state's repository and storehouse for its collection of geological samples from oil and gas wells and mineral properties and rock outcrops all across the state. We are in the process of relocating that from its current location in Eagle River to a new facility that the state purchased last year on Penland Parkway in downtown Anchorage. We're really excited about that. The new facility has more room for expansion of the collection, and it's going to have greatly improved facilities to allow industry to review and study the samples that we are housing there. Construction bids were closed today, and we're happy to report that we are able to afford the renovations to the facility, including all of the added alternatives that we had considered, and that construction will start this spring and be completed in the summer, and we plan on having a grand opening of the new facility this coming fall in September. The Engineering Geology Section initiated a hydrogeology program this year. And the main function of the hydrogeology program is to look at groundwater resources, availability, and use thereof, particularly with regard to resource development. And the main focus initially is going to be the oil and gas occurrences on the North Slope and how the groundwater interacts with those and how we can, shed some light on development. We also completed engineering geology work in cooperation with a variety of other groups. We worked with DOT and PF on the slide of the Yukon River Bridge, and we completed some field investigations along the various pipeline corridors from Livengood to Prudhoe Bay, and also did some work on the Susitna-Wautana Dam as well. Another interesting and very relevant collection of work that Engineering Geology Section does is the tsunami inundation mapping, which is of particular relevance to South Central Alaska and the coastal communities there. And we published tsunami inundation maps of Valdez and for Sitka and made those also available on the Internet. And finally, the Engineering Geology Section worked on coastal hazards assessment, primarily for storm surges and erosion issues on coastal communities in western and southwestern Alaska, where it seems to be becoming more of a problem. The volcanology section is part of the Alaska Volcano Observatory, which is a collaborative group formed between the USGS, the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and DGGS. And this group works on monitoring the volcanic activity in around the state and reporting that for interested parties, the airline industry, and travelers, and also local communities. The geological communication section runs our computer system, they run our internet site, they publish all our reports, so they really are integral to making everything that we do happen and getting the word out. They launched four new data sets last year, and this is kind of a new kind of data set for us where the data is available on the internet. You can browse it, you can query it, you can decide which data you want to download, and then you can select that data and download it directly. And that's leading that's a direction that I think that more and more of our information will be presented to the public and the industry. And along with that, they published 52 new geologic maps and reports, and recorded over 6 million web page hits throughout the year. And statistics that aren't on there, we have a Facebook presence, and between DGGS and AVO, we have over 40,000 likes on Facebook, and we have a Twitter account. Similarly, it has over 12,000 followers on Twitter, and we also have a presence on LinkedIn. So with that, I thank you for the opportunity to testify and turn it over to my colleague.
Thank you. I'll have to sign up on your Facebook page.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Marcy Menefee, and I'm the Executive Director of the Trustland Office. And I'll give you kind of a global overview of our accomplishments in the last year. But I'd like to talk a little bit about our mission and the charge that we have under the 1956 Mental Health Enabling Act, and that is to manage the Mental Health Trust land and natural resource assets to generate revenue for the mental health beneficiaries of the trust in the state of Alaska. The Trustland Office is a small 16-member staff of professionals who have different levels or types of expertise for these different assets. And the Land Office has been active for the last 19 years generating revenue from the various resources, and I believe the total revenue figures are over $150 million. But nevertheless, the Board of Trustees that we take a lot of direction and input from are very interested in us continuing to increase our annual revenue goals. And because of that, we've over the last 2 years spent a lot of time not only trying to make money and making money, but planning how to better maximize the programs that we have within the Land Office to look at a 5-year and a 10-year increase in revenue for the beneficiaries of the trust. So first I'd like to talk a little bit about timber. Our timber sales have over the years generated more than $40 million in revenue to the trust, but we've cut a lot of the trust timber, and we're able to put out 2 small sales this last year and generate about $1 million in revenue in Southeast. A couple of the other efforts related to managing the trust timber include land exchange with the federal government in Southeast of about 18,000 acres of trust land and a commensurate amount of federal land in the Tongass National Forest. That effort is making real progress. It's what's called an administrative exchange, in which both parties go through a process in which decisions are made, and then there's an NEPA process, and of course the public process that goes along with that. And we are in the initial phases of signing what's called an agreement to initiate, and the Region 10 folks the staff are working on reviewing a draft of what's called the feasibility analysis, and we're hopeful that this first quarter of 2014 we'll be able to sign some documents that commit both parties to moving the exchange ahead, and that's a very positive thing for the trust timber portfolio. The other initiative is in Southeast is just fresh off the dime here, and that is working with the University of Alaska and State Forestry to collaborate on ways to move ahead all the timber resources owned by state agencies in Southeast and get some of those resources to market. And so we're excited about that and really thankful for the cooperation we have with both of those agencies. Next, one of the hallmarks of revenue for the trust, of course, have been the land sale programs over the years, whether competitive or negotiated. I believe the less than 2% of the entire million acres that the state received for the mental health grant has been sold, and we like to keep that number down, keep that low. But those lands have generated about $4 million this last year, and the land section within the Trust Land Office has taken on subdividing larger parcels of land into smaller parcels of land because there seems to be great demand for some of the areas of trust land around the state, and we'd like to maximize revenue by selling smaller parcels. So we've taken on some new projects to do that, and even to build roads into subdivisions, and that's actually a new thing for our office. As far as coal and hard rock mining exploration and development, we really depend on those resources, and in the future we'll depend even more on those resources as some of the very the biggest sources of revenue in the mental health trust portfolio include things like the Fort Knox mine, Chewitna and Chicoloon coals, and then potential for gold development at Live and Good. The trust has a large land package there in addition to other agencies and private lands. And over the last several years, we've really tried to market the Mental Health Trust mineral lands, and currently have about 350,000 acres leased for either exploration or development of production of minerals, with our goal to increase that by up to 450,000, which would mean in this next year, if we're able to do that, almost half of the trust acreage would be then committed to hopefully producing some money with those coal and mineral assets. Moving on to oil and gas, this is a newer effort that is producing revenue for the trust. We had a small gas sale in Cook Inlet last year, and that with some of our other producing assets, we were able to net over $3 million in revenue for the trust, and we'd really like to see that program grow. And then finally, we have developed a newer program over the last 2 years under our previous director, who had a lot of personal experience and professional experience in real estate development. And with the support of the board and the commitment of financial assets from the board, we have begun acquiring commercial properties to create a revenue stream of a spendable income for the board from the rents that are paid on these commercial buildings. We've acquired one warehouse in Anchorage, another commercial building, multi-tenant commercial building in Anchorage, where we've moved our offices. Trust Land offices have now relocated there, and then we've acquired a couple of other larger facilities, and expect that program will just continue to bring in the kind of cash flow that the trustees are looking for from the management of those assets. Finally, I think I covered everything that was on the PowerPoint, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks very much, Marcy.
Thank you. You bet.
You had a question?
Yeah, sir? Just a quick one, if I may. Trust Timber.
Yes, sir.
Girth industry, do you think it's something that possibly could get Alaska substantially back in the timber industry someday with state land trades and federal trades with trust lands?
Senator Machicki, through the chair, that's a huge question. Certainly that we would like to be a part of that goal, and believe that with enough cooperation and collaboration and the markets the way they are, that's a possibility. We certainly have heard a lot of really negative news about that the timber industry not being able to survive, and it's, you know, the million-dollar question. Our hope is that if we are able to succeed in this exchange with the Forest Service, that we would be able to have a perpetual annual sustainable cut to the trust, but that's assuming that there would be an industry still alive in Alaska. Mm-hmm. The trust doesn't have enough timber resources to do that, and so again, it's got to be a combination of private and other state and hopefully federal timber resources available.
Good.
Thanks.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Senator Michiki, for the record, my name is Brent Goodrum. I'm the Director of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. And since I joined the Division of Mining, Land, and Water about 2.5 years ago, the division has been engaged in a comprehensive and multifaceted approach to eliminate a backlog of authorizations that had acquired over quite some time. One of our major accomplishments last year is, since we began this effort in earnest in fiscal year 12, we've reduced that permit backlog by 53.5%. We began at 2,658 authorizations in backlog, and on December 31st of this year, it was 1,237. So we've made some significant progress. Part of that, last year we issued 794 authorizations, which is the most that we've issued in quite some time. Additionally, that doesn't include another 724 authorizations for APMAs or applications for permits to mine in Alaska. And so a lot of authorizations went through our division last year. A critical component of continuing to modernize our permitting process is the modernization that we are pursuing via the Unified Permit Project. Last year, we introduced within the land use permit program the ability to have an electronic case file. This year, next month, we plan on our first release of our water rights process to similarly be in an electronic case file process. It's very important for us moving forward so we don't have a reoccurrence of a backlog, that we continue to make our processes better. Very quickly, a number of statewide projects that people in our division work, everything from the Port McKenzie Rail Extension, various roads to resource projects from the North Slope and elsewhere, North Slope oil and gas development and exploration. This year, we have authorized and we help oversee 377 miles currently of ice and snow roads on the North Slope. That is the most number of miles that we have seen up there in a very long time, and our folks help oversee that. Just last Friday, we issued a preliminary decision on Ada's LNG trucking decision that went out, and we also recently issued for the City and Borough of Juneau a decision on the cruise ship dock. They are very interested in. During the year last year, we also successfully amended the 2005 Bristol Bay amendment or area plan that had been litigated, and there was a settlement reached with the litigants to go through the administrative process with DNR. We held a number of public meetings in the area and received over 500 public comments. We successfully issued a decision to amend that plan. And in doing so, it increased the number of wildlife habitat classification by over 2.6 million acres, and also an increase of 1.1 million acres of public recreation areas within those plans. Those were all reclassified. Last September, we also worked closely with the BLM to come to a cooperative agreement to help resolve longstanding Native allotment issues. We put forth a program, a voluntary program, that allows those applicants to consider selecting substitute parcels on state-selected lands. And so we hope that will help resolve these issues that for many of them have lingered on for 40-plus years. And so we'll see how that project goes. Lastly, just an example of some stewardship efforts that our division undertakes. Almost to this day, a year ago, we worked closely with DEC and the U.S. Coast Guard on the removal of a couple submerged vessels from Jackalope Bay, put at risk the mariculture farms there, and it's an important issue to our folks in the division. So, thank you for the opportunity to share these accomplishments.
Great, thank you.
Good afternoon, Senators.
I'm Bill Barron, and I'm the Director of Oil and Gas for the State of Alaska. I'm not going to go through all the separate bullet points here. I think you guys can read at your leisure. But I do want to highlight just a few things of very interesting accomplishments and future projects that we've started. The first is a quarter of the way down on the page. It shows that we issued 90 leases within on North Slope at the last lease sale. It's not necessarily the importance of the 90 leases. It's that we processed all of those and issued those out in 7 weeks after the sale. Typically or historically, our ability to process leases after the lease sale have been upwards of 10 to 12 months. And through a diligent effort by the leasing team and other parties within the division to look at a process and understand what we're doing and why we're doing it, we became a little bit more efficient. Along those same lines, through this body last year, you gave us a new tool that we asked for, and that was for the ability to extend leases within the primary term, but when they were about to expire. And we immediately used that tool. We have had 6 applications brought to the division since that time, and we've issued 5 two-year lease extensions that incorporated bonding and firm work commitments. So the tool was needed. You guys gave it to us, and we thank you very much, and we immediately used that tool. The resource evaluation section, a group of very talented engineers and geoscientists. The bullet that I would like to highlight there is the recent effort that we've made in combination with the Department of Energy and the USGS relative to methane hydrates on the North Slope. The team looked very closely at the information they had, seismic information, well test data, and we've carved out a block of acres that we've pulled from the lease sale and dedicated those for research and development in association with the DOE under an MOU that former Commissioner Sullivan signed about a year ago, in fact, at LNG 17. It's a wonderful opportunity for the state, and I would present also for the country. This is really the largest area to be able to do methane hydrate research literally in the country. So it's a really interesting opportunity for us. In the commercial section, a lot of my talent there has been seconded by the commissioner and the deputy commissioner to work some of the pipeline and LNG issues. So that's, while it's an accomplishment, through being seconded. But I would offer that the final bullet there on the commercial section is, and it is out on our website, we've taken a really hard look at trying to figure out a way to evaluate the financial value of companies in terms of their ability to abandon or decommission and remove platforms in the inlet and then use that as a springboard to how do you establish bonding requirements or future requirements and their liabilities associated with DR&R across all activities. So it's a very interesting white paper. It is very highly academic. It was very well written. And if you do have an opportunity to go read that, I would encourage you to do so. The Petroleum Systems Integrity Office, kind of a silent group in our team. We really kind of farm these guys out every once in a while. And here recently, Alyeska's had a problem with a coupon failure that ended up in the line. And the talent within PSIO leaned in with the pipeline office and gave them some very clear guidance technically in terms of what could have happened, how does it work, and just we just really try and exercise that strength of our resources. And there is that little matter of managing $2.5 trillion, but that's a whole other issue. And with that, I will give it to Parks.
Thank you.
Trillion, excuse me. I wish it was trillion.
Senator Michiki, you had a question?
Bill, the white paper, I guess I can just send you an email to remind you. I'd like to find that without looking too hard.
Yes, sir.
That would be great. Thank you.
Hi, Ben.
Madam Chair, Senator Michiki, for the record, my name is Ben Ellis. I'm the director of Alaska State Parks. And be giving you a brief overview today of the 6 sections and accomplishments. I would like to note that your office should have received a letter from me this week and with some attachments that go to the areas that you represent in many cases. If you'd like to have a statewide look at those things, I have those also in the various park units. And I have started to do as I've done in the past, and I'll be back here the first week of February. My office either has been or will be in contact with your office to maybe set up a 10 to 15 minute session with you or a staffer. I look forward to hearing from you on your perceptions and thoughts of Alaska State Parks, and more importantly, those of your constituents. They help guide us as to management and other issues that we face, and they're very, very important. So I look forward to that. Many of you share those, and I've seen this. You shared some of your experiences in Alaska State Parks on your newsletter and websites. We appreciate that because it expands our ability to communicate with constituents about what is going on in their areas, and we appreciate that. Earlier, I heard the one division talking about Facebook. We have a Facebook page for Alaska State Parks. We have over 1,000 likes, and if you're not a member, we would love to have you. So I'll put that little promo in. From this slide, it focuses on the six areas that we have on Alaska State Parks. I'd just like to talk about them very, very briefly. When people think of parks, they usually think of the very first one, which is our largest employment sector, and that is Parks and Outdoor Recreation Management. We have 3.5 million acres in Alaska State Parks. It is the largest state park system in the nation. It has the largest park, Wood-Tikchik, at 1.6 million. The number three park, Tugetch, at right at a half a million or 500,000 acres. We have 82 permanent employees with 23 non-perms. But I'd like to point out we have 800 or so volunteers. And so it is the collaboration between the professional staff and the volunteers that are able to carry out the directions that this body has set forth and the various things that you've asked us to do. You know, we've got 124 park units, 72 campgrounds. I'm not going to go through all of it, but we've got a lot of infrastructure out there in many areas, and we appreciate your support of that as our deferred maintenance and infrastructure needs to be addressed. Of the areas, let me also mention about the Alaska Trails Office. They provide two grants. It's like a pass-through office, very much so, where the Recreational Trails Program, which is a federally funded program, about $1.6 million annually, comes in through that particular revenue stream. Half of that is dedicated to communities and local trail programs, whether it's Trail Mix or Alaska Trails, or I mean, there's a number of them throughout the state. They do an excellent job. And so they apply for grants, and then there is a board that evaluates those grant proposals, and then it comes to me with their recommendations. The other half of the funds support Alaska State Park Trails, and with our trail management, we have over 900 miles of trails, of developed trails in Alaska State Parks. The other area that the Trails Program oversees is our Snow Track Program, which receives about $225,000 to $250,000 a year from the snow machine registration fee. And it goes into, there's a board there that also makes recommendations to the director on how to use those fees. Primarily, they're used for grooming, which has been the direction of the Snow Track Board. We also have safety and educational programs that we support. I'll say that the demand far outstrips the funding available. So it's very challenging, and I think the program does a very good job trying to put money on the ground in the areas that are heavily used by snow machiners through a snow machine grant pool area. The last several years, we've been involved in a first day hike, which is on January 1st. All 50 state parks are involved in this, and it's to kick off the new year with getting people outside. And we've had at Hatcher Pass and skis and snowshoes, and we've had walks, and it's been a very, very successful program. It has grown every year, and we're excited about that. Many folks do not realize that the Office of History and Archaeology is under the Alaska State Parks Outdoor Recreational Division. They do a fantastic job. There's 12 archaeologists and 7 historians, and they deal with about a $2.5 million budget, and primarily that is federal funds that come through. And what is amazing is that they review about 2,600 projects a year, and they are looking at protecting the state's resources in historical and archaeological cultural aspects, and serve as a way to make these projects move forward, but yet in a way that is protects these areas. And they work with the Corps of Engineers and other federal programs, usually, and communities. Our design and construction staff is a very, what I consider an enterprise staff. We've got about 15 or 16 employees in that section, engineers, landscape architects, etc., interpreters, and only, I think it's 2 positions of the 15 or comes out of general fund. Everything else comes out of projects that either we're working on in state parks on deferred maintenance or capital improvement, or there's about 15 or so agencies, whether they're state or federal, that contract with us to do their design and construction work. And so it is a way that we're looking at, and maybe other ways to provide a sustainable state park system as we look at declining revenues. So I'm very, always very proud of that area. And our boating safety program, they have had, you know, more than almost 2,951 classes in schoolrooms since it began, and they've reached at least 104,000 students during this time period. 24 Alaskan children have been, it's been documented that they survived a cold water immersion because they had Kids Don't Float life jacket on. You've probably seen those Kids Don't Float jackets. They're on almost all of the launches area. And this program has provided nearly 50,000 life jackets for that program. And it's a program that's in conjunction with the local communities and is also a federally funded program, much like our trails program through the Federal Highways Act. The last area I'd like to talk about is the something that's very exciting. It is the first developed campground in Alaska State Parks in 30 years, and it's the South Denali Visitor Center Complex. And starting in 2009, this body has started to provide funding for a visitor center and related campgrounds and trails along the Parks Highway, and that for a number of years, basically from 2009 until this past summer, the legislature had been adding to that. It's about a $47 million project. It's not a little project. It's a big project for state parks. But we have accumulated about $20 million in state funding, $1 million from a private corporate donation, about $1 million from a federal grant. So about $22 million presently. Instead of waiting and saying, well, what are you going to do with this? And when's this? We've decided to put that money to work. And so we, this past summer, had a groundbreaking and have punched in about 2.3 miles of a road. It's in the photograph there, into a campground That has been cleared and brushed, and we will get into that campground and start setting it up. Next year, it'll have 35 RV campsites, and there will be a 15 walk-in campsite area. There's a number of amenities and trail expansion in that area. Depending upon the weather, we would like to be able to get into, at least do a shakedown of the campground next fall. But weather in that area is always dicey as far as knowing what we're going to have, whether it's snow or rain. So we'll see. One thing I would like to point out is that this project has energized about 23 miles of the park's highway, so that there's tremendous economic development in that area that hadn't been before. So we're very pleased at that, and we look forward to having you folks come visit us when we're open. So, thank you very much.
Great, thank you.
Madam Chair and Senator Machiki, my name is Tom Crawford, and I'm the Director of DNR's Office of Project Management and Permitting, or OPUMP as it's commonly referred to. And in the bullets that you have before you, you'll note that the term coordinate appears in, I think, virtually every one of those bullets. And that's because that's fundamentally is what OPUMP's role is, that we work to coordinate the permitting process for large development projects of a variety of different types, mining, oil and gas, transportation, alternative energy, and we ourselves have no regulatory authority. We work to coordinate the participation of the different state regulatory agencies, try to increase permitting efficiencies, and to help, you know, everybody kind of navigate what is sometimes a very murky permitting process. Additionally, OPUMP is also involved with coordination of state agency review and comment on a variety of federal policy initiatives and programs, and of which, frankly, there seems to be no end. And so that's kind of fundamentally what OPUMP does. For these private sector projects, those are funded through a memorandum of understanding that we enter into with project applicants. That's for the private sector. Now, if the applicant is a state agency, then it's in the form of a reimbursable services agreement. So much of OPUMP's funding is in the form of what are these statutorily designated program receipts. And in terms of kind of things that that we have been working on this past year, or new projects, the first bullet there you see, we signed MOUs with Buccaneer on this actually applies to a number of different projects that they're working on in Cook Inlet, as well as the Cosmo project in particular, which is the offshore gas field just off of Deep Creek. Pardon me. Signed an MOU with Link for their Umiat property, which is in roughly the southeast corner of NPRA, and an MOU with NORDAC, and this is on their Tulamonic property, which is, this is an exploration stage right now, but that's in the NPRA, and then also with ConocoPhillips regarding the process of the development permitting for their Greater Moose's Tooth property, also in the NPRA. On the mining side, we signed two new memorandum of understanding this year, one with Graphite One, which is a company that has a graphite property on the Seward Peninsula, northeast of Teller, I'm a geologist by my training, and I think that this is something that stands a very strong likelihood of actually being developed. It's a very interesting occurrence. Then additionally, we signed recently an MOU with Freegold regarding their Golden Summit property, which is near near Cleary Summit, very close to the Fort Knox mine. And this is just in the early stages. And one of the things we really kind of work to facilitate is a pre-application dialogue between these project proponents and the agencies to make sure that the right information is being collected and that that the permitting process doesn't stall out at a later point in time because they just don't have the right information. And we like to say that what we fundamentally are proponents for the process, not for the projects, but for the process. One of those additional projects in Cook Inlet was Apache's seismic exploration. The Apache has got a very large property position in Cook Inlet, but some of those properties are in holdings within the Kenai Wildlife Refuge, and there's been kind of a delicate dance, if you will, getting the necessary permits and authorizations to conduct the seismic survey within the refuge. Worked long and hard with the state agencies and interfacing with the federal agencies and proponents from King Cove and the Aleutians Borough in regards to the Eisenbeck Land Exchange to provide for that construction of a road between King Cove and Cold Bay. Unfortunately, that didn't work out really well, and on the December 23rd, Secretary Jewell handed down her decision denying that exchange. I don't think any of us believe that we've heard the last about Eisenbeck, though. We were involved with coordinating the state agency review of EPA's Bristol Bay assessment, and this is in regards to mining and potential impacts on fish in the Bristol Bay watershed, and that was actually a fairly complicated process of pulling together the input from the different state agencies, and I think everyone's aware that EPA finalized that assessment and issued it on January 14 of this year. For the Red Dog mine, and one of the things that actually we were very, very pleased with is that the Red Dog had for the first time its environmental audit, and environmental audits are something that that we typically build into the permitting requirements for mining projects. Wherein every 5 years we conduct this third party environmental audit at the owner's expense, and it looks at the performance of the operation and what, if anything, should be changed in their new permits. And it just turns out that because when Red Dog was originally permitted, it was before a lot of our current statutes were in place, and so despite the fact that Red Dog's been in operation since 1989, this was their first environmental audit, and we're very pleased to have gotten through that, and that's going to feed into new permit conditions, as I mentioned. For the Pogo property, Pogo has had some real exploration successes, and that's the gold mine, underground gold mine, not far from Delta Junction. They have really found a lot of additional reserves, and so there has been this recent process of permitting the expansion of the operation to access this East Deep deposit. And as part of that, the continued operation of that property then needs to have additional tailings storage. Pogo is in the form of a dry stack, and so that was accomplished this year as well. For the Greens Creek mine, actually somewhat similar kind of a thing. Greens Creek mine is not far from here in the Tongass. It's on land administered by the Forest Service, and they were running out of space for the storage of their tailings. We got through an EIS this year to provide for the expansion of that tailings facility, and the state agencies are currently working on the issuance of permits. And then finally, the final bullet here is that regarding the Donlin Creek project, and that's the gold occurrence, and really very, very substantial gold occurrence that's near Crooked Creek on the Kuskokwim River. It's been in an EIS, and one of OPUM's project coordinators is coordinating the state agency's participation as cooperating agency in that EIS. And that will continue for probably a chunk of time yet. And thank you. That's just some highlights from OPUM.
Thank you, Tom.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Senator Machicki. For the record, my name is Allison Iverson, and I am the Acting Director of the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office. Our office mission, as stated, is to issue leases of state land for pipeline rights-of-way. We also implement the state's policy set forth in Alaska Statute 3835 concerning development use and control of pipeline transportation systems within the state. So a list of some of our key accomplishments. The first one, we worked really closely with BP Transportation Alaska to transfer the Badami Pipeline rights-of-way leases to Newtok Pipeline, which is a conglomerate of Savant Alaska and ASRC Exploration, a subsidiary of ASRC. Second, when we released the 2013 annual report, and this annual report, we tried to make it more user-friendly. And if you haven't seen it, I encourage you to visit our website or contact me, and I can send you a copy. It's important in that it really lays out the key functions of both DNR as well as the other state agencies that are co-located within the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office. It also summarizes the lessees' annual reports, which lay out their important work that they've undertaken, and also details our compliance efforts, which I think are really important on these pipelines. We worked with Conoco to facilitate the change of service for the Aliktok pipeline from natural gas liquids to natural gas, and that should be, I believe, finalized in by mid-2014. We've been working really hard on an amended application for the Transforland Pipeline Company. This initially was sponsored by Cook Inlet Energy. It's currently sponsored by Tesoro. It's a 28-mile pipeline underneath Cook Inlet, and we anticipate the preliminary decision to be issued within the next couple weeks, maybe month, very soon. We've been working closely on several projects for a North Slope LNG facility with trucking to Fairbanks. We have completed the process and issued a right-of-way lease for Spectrum LNG. We have completed the commissioner's analysis and proposed decision for the Polar project. We anticipate an additional application coming in for the ADA project, so that's taken up a good portion of our time. With regard to TAPS, we last year had 5 TAPS amendments, and these were to add minor amounts of land, but they were for really important work, critical work for upgrades, regular maintenance, and improvements to the system. Additionally, Director Barron referenced a recent pipeline incident and a coupon failure. That incident, the highlight, I think, and the takeaway at this point, we're still working with Alyeska on their follow-up and their implementation of their corrective actions, so perhaps more to come. But I think the takeaway at this point in time is it was a great example of utilizing state and federal agency expertise. We really worked through the Joint Pipeline Office in that the state and federal agencies spoke with one voice, which was not by any means an easy effort and took a lot of coordination and time to achieve that. But I do think it was a helpful for Alyeska, certainly to be sure that we were giving a clear understanding of what our expectations were from both state and federal agencies. The next year, we've been working really closely with the Alaska Standalone Pipeline, sponsored by AGDC, and the AKLNG pipeline, coordinating efforts for their permitting activities for field seasons last summer and upcoming, anticipate a very large field season for both projects. We're not only coordinating DNR permits and issuing DNR permits, but we're working with other state agencies, particularly the DOT and the Department of Fish and Game and the DNR Office of History and Archaeology. So large coordination efforts, and even though there may not be many permits issued, the permits cover very large activities. For instance, one permit for the Alaska Standalone Pipeline covered over 200 boreholes. So very large activities and important work. Lastly, we are spending a lot of field time overseeing the initial construction of the Point Thompson Export Pipeline. Last winter, they constructed, installed approximately 2,200 vertical and horizontal support members, and they'll be back out in the next couple of months finalizing the construction of the pipeline. So that will be new efforts to report on next year.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks, Allison.
Madam Chair and Senator Machicki, my name is Jean Davis. There we go. Changed the slide. And I am the director of the Support Services Division. We've presented today alphabetically, so I get to go last and back cleanup, and it gives me the opportunity to really point out that what everything you've heard from all my colleagues in the background is absolutely, you know, what DNR is all about. The Support Services Division is exactly that. We're here to provide the administrative support necessary to keep these all these great activities going forward. The department itself is about 1,000 employees, and we're in 32 locations across the state, so coordinating all of that activity is sometimes challenging. We have some typical administrative services. The IT section provides, obviously, the IT infrastructure required for managing state land records for our network and desktop servers and mapping, et cetera. We have our financial services, our accounting. We pay all the bills, everything that we incur there. We record all the revenue for the state. The division's hard work required us to record about $2.6 billion in revenue last year onto the state accounting system. We have a budget section, which provides budget support and development of the budget, helping with legislative presentations on the budget. I know you're both on our budget subcommittee. So we'll be coming before you again with budget items. We have a procurement section that does everything from supporting small, easy equipment purchases to the real complex contracts that the Division of Forestry engages in for aviation, or that many of our field offices do, establishing field camps in the summer season, to, you know, the complex economic analysis kinds of contracts that come out of DNR. We also do the human resources support for the division, all of the position recruitment and hiring, the division of personnel kind of support for that. We don't do all the hiring. We do all of the vetting of the final approvals and all of the postings, and basic management services for our HR. And the one piece that's not typically in an admin services support unit, we do administer the state recording offices through the Support Services Division statewide. Leads me into some of the basic, I would say, key accomplishments that we've done beyond our normal business here. Is we did implement electronic recording. We call it e-recording, and we had implemented in 91% of our recording districts, 31 of 34, in 2013. And e-recording allows all of our customers, which the biggest customers are title companies and banks and lawyers, to file their business documentation electronically. Keeps them from having to come into the office all the time, to be in exactly the same physically in the district that they need to record in, and has really helped us provide better service, especially where we have some single staffed offices and folks like to take a vacation or unexpected absence. As of last week, we actually brought the last three recording districts on, so we are now 100% implemented, available for e-recording, making Alaska the fourth state to implement statewide e-recording. Our IT section has supported a lot, especially in the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, the efforts with the permitting initiative going forward, working with automation, installing the business process management servers and software, and providing programming support and contract management on a pretty significant automation effort there. And our finance and procurement staff, and soon our HR staff, are spending a significant amount of time in collaboration with Department of Administration on the what you might hear is the IRIS project, which is the statewide administrative systems replacement. It's the accounting system, the HR system, payroll, and procurement. So we're working very closely with them and putting a lot of resources into that. And I thank you.
Very good. Thanks, Gene.
That's a good question.
Question, Senator Machiki?
They're switching off. Does support services handle the hunting permit drawings that are coming up in February?
Through the chair, the hunting permit drawings?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Okay.
Fishing wildlife, fishing game. Department of Fish and Game.
They're under DNR, so.
They're not under DNR.
Welcome, Commissioner. This was a great presentation. I just want to tell you, it was very interesting to have the different division heads. So thank you for doing that.
And Madam Chair, I just hope that each member of the committee knows and that you and your staff know that if there are any questions we can answer, information we can gather to help this committee get its business done on time this year, we look forward to the next 84 days. And we're here to help. You know, I think we have in the past talked about the world-class resources that Alaska enjoys, and we have world-class managers. The men and women behind me are the leadership that help us get the job done on behalf of Alaskans every day, and I couldn't be prouder to work with every one of them.
I have to agree with you. You have a wonderful department. I do have a question. I was looking at the budget that's been put forth. Of course, we know that hasn't gone through the sausage-making process yet. But I noticed that DNR had a budget cut in the governor's proposed budget. How would you manage that?
Madam Chair, the department was fortunate in that the gas pipeline project office is a line item that was built into our base, and with the elimination of that office, in the end, we're able to realize a net negative for the agency, but we were able to maintain funding for all of our other divisions and in some cases address some much-needed requirements for personnel costs and increments, especially in the Division of Parks.
Great. Good. Good to know. Any questions, Senator Machiki?
Nope.
All right. Thank you very much to all of you for coming in.
Thank you for sticking it out on a Friday afternoon.
Very good. Well, this concludes our business for today. Our next meeting will be Monday, January 27th. We will have the Department of Natural Resources back again and the Department of Revenue, and we'll be taking up gas line issues. So at this time, I'll adjourn the meeting. The time is 4:54 p.m.